there was a family sitting right behind me who went out yesterday, and so they were seeing the film Sunday night, late Sunday night, and I sat watching that film, you know, and the subtitles coming along, and particularly the father behind me, every once in a while he'd go, I didn't see anything funny going. But he understood Swedish, and he was getting some of the things that weren't in the subtitles. So I was wondering what else was going on there, and I was wishing I could be sitting there with a set of earphones on, you know, and somebody doing the fast, perfect translation from the Swedish. So if any of you talk Swedish, you have.
I know the guy sitting behind you, he doesn't understand a word of Swedish. Yeah. He just laughs at anything. Yeah,
he was laughing too.
That makes you feel better, huh?
Yeah. No, I talked to some people afterwards, and they said it loses something in the translation. I said it may lose something in the translation, but there's an awful lot there. Ernie was there and having a great time last night. He had his hearing aid turned off and didn't miss a thing. Gertrude, I think Beanie's going tonight. We'll turn his hearing aid off and have a good time. So, how many of you saw it last night or Sunday night? Got to check this. Oh, pretty good number. See it again or go if you haven't seen it tonight, because I think it's one of the great films, and it's one of the few films which concerns itself with the question of great human disaster from a theological standpoint. Now, we're living at a time right now, and I don't know how much longer this time is going to last, but we're living at a time right now where in a popular film medium, disaster is good box office. You know, we had Earthquake, and we had the film about the skyscraper that was on fire, and they're redoing the Titanic, sinking of the Titanic, you know, and it's kind of in to have big disaster films and, you know, do the spectacular staging bit and watch people's reactions as their world goes up in flames or collapses. Flies all over the place. And these are all apocalyptic type experiences. Now I'm going to be talking about Revelation 8 and 9 this morning, but I'm going to be doing it in the context of Bergman's film The Seventh Seal. And I'm aware, you know, can hardly avoid, after I ask for a show of hands, being aware of the fact that many of you saw it now and many of you haven't seen it. Just to give you a little side pitch, Sarah and Al and Dick and I are going to be chatting with one another here at 3 this afternoon, and we will explain all mysteries and everything else about Bergman. Anything that we don't know, Sarah does. So we guarantee that all will be answered. So come with your questions about something you didn't understand about the film, or there's some idea you have, want to try it out on us and see what our reaction is, and so on. Give you one provocative little thought between now and then. Did you notice that the young couple who survived are named Joseph and Mary? Only their little boy isn't named Jesus, his name is Michael, the same as the archangel who will blow the last trumpet. That's something for you to think about between now and this afternoon. Okay? Now that we have your interest piqued. And if you haven't seen the film and are going to see it tonight, you know, also feel free to come. Because, you know, it helps to have some idea what's going on. And then at 4 o'clock over in Sarah's chalet, there will be a reading of the script, which is in this book. I guess there's still a few copies left, but at any rate, them as comes, we'll get parts and read the script, and that's also helpful, both before and after having seen the film, and we'll give you some new understandings that you didn't have before, including the understanding that Hey, I don't remember hearing, seeing that line of dialogue, or if you understand Swedish, I don't remember hearing anybody say that, and you go and see it again. Sure enough, they did, only you missed it. Okay, now, the film is concerned with human disaster, and certainly the time that the film is treating is probably, with the exception of the flood, the greatest human disaster in the history of the world. Because between the years of 1347 and 1351, one-third of the world's population died. One-third of the world's population died in a stretch of 4 years, 5 years, a period of 5 years. Now, there were several outbreaks again in the next century that were kind of minor, but this was a major one. It began in China. As a matter of fact, the bubonic plague was raging in China in 46, and the emperor of China was very happy about it because he was suffering from the usual Chinese problem, overpopulation, and it was very handy to cut the population down. So he did very little to get rid of it. Trade with the Orient had begun and was going great guns, and so they brought back from Cathay perfumes and firecrackers and parchment paper and the bubonic plague. You know, the shipboard rats got acquainted with the Chinese rats and picked up bubonic plague from the rat flea and carried it back to Europe. So it hit Europe, first of all, at Venice, which at that time was the dominant port. And then it moved across to Milan, and it moved through southern Europe and up toward northern Europe. By 50, it had reached England, and in 51, it hit Scandinavia. In 1344, the last crusade took place. Now, I'm putting these two together because those of you that saw the film know that the main character in the film is a knight returning from the crusades who then encounters the Black Death in Sweden. So the last crusade had occurred at that time. It was a miserable failure. They didn't even get to Palestine. They had gradually, over a period of several crusades, been pushed out of Palestine. They no longer held the sacred places of Christendom. And so a kind of combination of theological failure in the last crusade, because that was the social action of the day. You know, where today the church may concern itself about black rights or Indian rights or world hunger or something of that sort. In that day, the social activists were concerned with freeing the holy places of Palestine from the infidel and drive back the Turk. And, you know, it was a miserable failure. So we have a man coming back to Sweden who had been a knight, an unsuccessful soldier in the fighting of the church against the infidel, and the church is losing and the Turk is winning, and we'll keep on winning for at least another century, and we'll reach the high water point at the gates of Vienna and then be driven back by Charles V and keeps him so busy he can't burn the heretic Martin Luther. So at any rate, it'll continue for another century where Christianity will be losing on the military political front. The Black Death spreads all over Europe and nobody knows what to do about it. And so there is a kind of attempt to escape from it, run away from it. Then there's a kind of fatalism about it. And then there's a kind of blaming people for it. Now, the film doesn't present one thing, I wish it did, But it does not present one of the things that was very characteristic of the reaction to what was going on, and that is killing of Jews. A great many Jews were burned at the stake because they were blamed for the Black Death. And the thought spread around Europe, the Jews have polluted the drinking supply of the Christians. They are practicing genocide, and a great many Jews were killed by the church. The church as hierarchy was pretty much frozen. They didn't know what to do. The papacy was at Avignon most of this century. There were competitions back and forth. Many people thought that the church was dying because they had left Holy Rome. There was an effort to maintain a kind of false gaiety in Avignon and pretend that the Black Death wasn't going on. Beautiful story that depictures a kind of mood at that time is Edgar Allan Poe's The Mask of Red Death, a little short story where people are hidden back in a castle to try to escape, you know, and it appears in the midst of them. Boccaccio's Decameron, of course, is a group of young people who are holed up out in the country, and Boccaccio lived during this time. But it's very difficult for us to imagine people's feelings and people's thoughts at a time like this, and I think this is one way in which this film is highly dramatic. Next week, Wednesday, a week from tomorrow, is the 30th anniversary of another Armageddon, when we dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima, and we will likely remind ourselves of that at the village here, and that brought a new sense of the end of times to our generation, a sense which particularly has bothered those who probably were born from the early 40s on. You know, because many of us, you know, most of us that are here this morning remember a time when the atomic bomb didn't exist. But those who don't, you know, have a kind of a undercurrent of awareness of every moment the possibility of the destruction of the universe, and they tend to look at the ultimate questions of life in a different kind of way than we do. And so I think we'll find the Seventh Seal helpful to see people in a time which was different from ours and yet in a sense is like ours. And the kind of theological questions which concern a time like that. And it's a time which tends to take a new look at the Book of Revelation, because the Book of Revelation is, after all, a book about the end times. What people tend not to realize is that the Book of Revelation is also a book about the beginning times. And I suspect Fred was commenting before about one commentary read on Revelation where the author simply compared the Book of Genesis with the Book of Revelation for similarities, and I suspect it might be interesting sometime to read the Book of Revelation to understand our beginnings as well as to understand our ends. I think the Seventh Seal goes well with this portion of the Book of Revelation because in the Seventh Seal we get kind of a human reaction to what's going on. In the Book of Revelation we get a divine revelation about what life's all about and what we may look for and why we may see it as we do. Now, there are as many interpretations of what the Book of Revelation means as there are books that are the authentic interpretation of the Book of Revelation. Brett mentioned to me that he had 18. I expect there are probably several hundred, and I have yet to find two versions of or two commentaries on the Book of Revelation that agree to any great extent on on the various images, symbols, and so on. And this is, of course, what makes the book provocative, particularly to people who like to unravel mysteries. I think there are much more practical uses for it than that. But let's get down into that instead of talking about it. I have contended for many years that the theologians of the church spend so much time talking about theology, talking about the Bible, that they don't have time to do the Bible, and so I'm guilty of the same thing myself. I thought we'd talk a little bit about 8 and 9 because those are sections which are referred to in the movie, explicitly referred to in the movie. But in order to get a little background on that, we have to begin about chapter 5, because St. John, after telling us that he had the heavens open for him so that he could look into the very mysteries of the throne of God, and after depicting the various forms and figures which were present then, he tells us that a scroll was brought out and it had 7 seals on it. Now, a scroll, of course, was a writing parchment. Obviously, there is a message inside this scroll, and there are 7 seals which are attached to it, and you have to remove the 7 seals in order to understand the message. When the first seal is removed, a white horse with a rider holding a bow comes and goes out conquering and to conquer. Now, obviously, he's a military sort of person, and he is riding a white horse. Now, some people have seen this as a particular historical figure, like Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar or somebody like that. Most commentators have identified white with purity, and so he was a kind of a good guy. Some people have seen that we have 4 here, and remember there are 4 Gospels, and think there might be an analogy there. I suspect that when one sees the 4th seal removed and there is a pale horse and the rider's name is Death, that in some sense or other, all 4 of these first 4 are forms of affliction on the earth, or sorts of things to which the earth is subject, which sap its vitality and shorten its existence. The 2nd seal is opened, and there is a red horse. The rider is dressed in red, he carries a sword, and he causes war. Well, that's sort of obvious one. The 3rd one, there's a black horse. The rider is carrying a pair of scales, and when you see what the rider is crying, he's obviously living in a time of inflation and may represent that sort of thing. 4th one is a pale horse. The rider is named Death, and he has powers over 1/4 of the earth. The 5th seal is opened, and lo and behold, John sees all the holy martyrs, which are protected under the altar of God, and they want to be freed and released so that they can enjoy the glories of the presence of God. And they have to wait until all of the martyrs have been gathered. The 6th seal is open, and the destruction of the earth begins to occur. And from this point on, I sure wish I had Larry Collins here. Any of you have heard Larry Collins' discussion of Atlantis and his discussion of what happens on the earth when a volcano literally blows up. Some of these things start looking very, very familiar, and I'd love to have Larry's insights as a geologist commenting on some of the phenomena which are described here, because they sound awfully much like some of the ancient volcanic eruptions that destroyed whole, little sizable islands and things of this sort in the ocean. But at any rate, the destruction of the earth begins to occur, and then there is a holding off until the rest of those who are to be saved have been discovered and marked for eternity. Now, one of the common characteristics that you find in the book of Revelation is you move up to a certain point and then there's a kind of a stop. And so also we'll find in the very first passage, which is quoted in the movie The Seventh Seal, we're told that that the angel opened the seventh seal and then there was silence in the heaven for about a half hour. This kind of gets reflected in the movie where death gets stalled off for a period of time and the knight plays chess with him. And there's a kind of a stopping of what is supposed to happen temporarily. So also in chapter 8, as we come to the seventh seal, the seventh and last seal, after which the scroll will unroll and we can see what's inside. The seal is plucked off, and for a period that seemed like about half hour, there is a silence in the heavens. Nothing is happening. There's a kind of a waiting period. I suppose it's sort of like when you're in the eye of a hurricane, something like that, where there's a feeling of ominousness, but it hasn't really happened. And this is I think beautifully captured in the film, where you get a premonition when they find the man who has died on the shore, but then nothing really happens, but there's the premonition that it's going to happen, and there's this silence period. I suspect God works that way. If you think back to the flood, God gave the word about the flood, and then there was a silence for a couple of centuries until the flood, and then the flood came. So there was a waiting time. And we have to remind ourselves that we're living in the waiting time. And that God has told us that his universe is going to end and that it will end in his time. But we're waiting. And we're in the time for the gathering in of those who will be saved. Verses 3 to 5, the prayers of the faithful are arising to heaven in this time. Prayers are coming up like incense to heaven, rising like smoke. And then the angel of the Lord gives a response and he hurls the censer down to the earth and there is a loud explosion. And then things begin to happen. And there are seven angels who are trumpeters, and one by one they raise their trumpet and blow. And when they blow their trumpet, then things begin to happen on the earth. Now, obviously the image which John is using here is the image of the herald at the royal court. And even though we have virtually no royal courts today except in Scandinavia, still, we use the trumpeter upon occasion. We use the trumpeter on the 4th of July here to get us all out of bed. And there's something about the trumpet and the call of the trumpet that, sends a shiver up and down your back, and you know something's going to happen. And so the angels trumpet the end of the world. The first one blows his trumpet after the seventh seal has been opened, and there's hail and fire and blood, and one third of the earth burns. Now, one mathematical symbol which will occur regularly through here is the one third. You say one third of this was lost, one third of that was lost, and so on. I suspect one doesn't have to take that quite literally, but the expression is that, there's going to be a partial destruction. Those who are very concerned about energy consumption and other things of this sort are very much aware of the fact that we may be living in apocalyptic times, and that we're, you know, we're wiping out our oil, and then we'll wipe out this, and then we'll wipe out that, and we're living, you know, we're living perhaps on a dying planet because we're killing it off. See, and it goes, and it's just gradually going, and we don't do something about it, you know, reached a point of no return, and there it goes. We have the capacity to make it go fast or to make it go slow. I suspect what's likely to happen is neither one of these, but something, but a third alternative. But at any rate, the first trumpeter calls down hail, fire, and blood upon the earth. Many commentators see this as an analogy to some of the early plagues that afflicted Egypt. And I was reminded of Larry at that point, because one of Larry's admittedly speculative arguments about the children of Israel leaving Egypt is that a certain volcano blew up in the Grecian islands where the city of Atlantis was located, and that the effects of this down in Egypt were of such a nature that the things which are described in the Torah would be accounted for on geological grounds. Well, I don't know. But at any rate, we have the beginning of the destruction. The second trumpeter blows, and something like a blazing mountain falls into the sea. A giant heavenly body falls into the ocean. And a third of the sea becomes like blood. A third of the fish are killed, and a third of the ships are destroyed. Number three, a star falls from the sky, and it pollutes many of the rivers and springs. And he then says the star's name is Wormwood, which rings a sympathetic bell with all C.S. Lewis lovers, you know, because that poor fumbling devil who never seemed to do things right was named Wormwood. Poisons all the rivers. Has anybody here ever drunk Wormwood? A wormwood water. I am the only one present that ever has. Which, you want to know what wormwood tastes like?
Yeah.
when I was bickering, I began to have tummy trouble, and I suspect most of my tummy trouble was due to the fact that I was sleeping about 4 or 5 hours a night. You know, there were so many things I was doing that I just didn't have time to go to bed. Well, there was a nice elderly old nurse at the old folks' home where I spent part of my time chaplaining. And she said she had just the right thing for me. Wormwood water. What she did was she got some wormwood. Where she got that from, I'll never know. But she got some wormwood, and she boiled it up in water, and then she put it in the refrigerator to get it real chilled so that you could hardly taste it. Now, a better emetic I have never tasted in my life. I've never seen anything that came up as fast as it went. Well, I ate my meals at the old folks' home, so I could hardly avoid her. And she was a dear old soul. But at any rate, I finally, on about the fourth try, I finally got the stuff down. And boy, it worked wonders. I had a gut like iron. I told my bishop about it, and he laughed. And he says, yes, she tried that on me once too. And he said, I'll bet. He said, any stomach that could keep that stuff down has to be iron. He says, I can't imagine anything that would be more traumatic for the stomach than that stuff. So if you can tolerate that stuff, you can tolerate anything. Well, it kind of straightened me out, and I don't know whether it was the wormwood that straightened me up, or the fear of having take wormwood. My stomach didn't dare get out of line again. But at any rate, it just has a very strange taste. And it tastes sort of like what I said, you know what burdock smells like? You know, it has these little round prickly balls on it that when you walk through burdock, the stuff sticks in your pants. And it's kind of a funny, musty smell. Well, it tastes sort of like burdock. And it's not really poisonous, as you can see. I'm living proof that it's not really poisonous. But it is, you know, there's a certain icky awfulness about it. A certain musty, decayed kind of effect about it. And I can imagine that, you know, that if you took wormwood literally and these streams got polluted by wormwood, nobody could drink it because they couldn't keep the water down. They'd vomit it right back up again. All right, number four. One third of the sun, moon, and stars are darkened, and we get a very peculiar phenomenon that occurs. Because it's not just that it gets dark. Because St. John says that the light loses some of its power, but also the darkness lost some of its power. You know, and how do you understand darkness losing some of its power? We all know what light losing some of its power might be like, but how does darkness lose some of its power? About the closest I've ever come to an idea of what that must be like is in Milton's Paradise Lost. You recall when Lucifer and the angels all fall from heaven and they get down to that lake of burning fire and they land on the shore of the lake. And Milton describes the condition there as darkness visible. Isn't that an interesting expression? Darkness visible. And they're living in this sort of half-lightish existence until the end of time when they are to be destroyed in the fire. Okay, at this point an eagle flies through the air announcing there are three more woes to come. Been a lot of speculation about that eagle. Those of us that are St. John lovers know what the symbol of St. John is, you know, the eagle. You know, and that gets a little bit provocative. But anyway, they're told there are three more woes to come. Don't think it's over now. You got two-thirds of the universe left and don't think it's over now. There are three woes to come. So comes woe number five in chapter 9, and the abyss opens up to unleash demonic creatures which are sort of like locusts. The month of August, we get some kind of conception of what that must be like because the flies around here bite unmercifully. And they just sit there and they chew on you. You know, when you go like this and they don't move, you finally just have to pick them up and throw them with you. And they come back and they sit there and they chew on you some more. And St. John describes this as a condition where one is stung but one cannot die. So this is a kind of a almost Hades type of stage of development where people are moving to the point where existence is becoming so terrible that they wish it would end, and it doesn't. You know, it's a kind of a foretaste of hell where you wish you no longer existed or there was some kind of way you could be unaware of what's going on, and it's just impossible to lose your consciousness of it or to cease to exist. The sixth plague comes, and it is a plague of fire, smoke, and sulfur which destroys a third of mankind. And then we have a kind of a temporary hiatus until we get to 1115 when the seventh trumpet sounds. And remarkably enough, what happens after the seventh trumpet is not the end of the world, but the coming of the kingdom. The coming of the rule of God the domination of God over the universe. Oh, that's the seventh seal, and those are the seven trumpeters that come. And I think it can be understood in at least two kinds of ways. I think that in one kind of way, it reminds us that the life which we live is a life which is unstable, and a world which is unstable, and a world which constantly is being held together by the creative hands of God. And if He weren't constantly holding it together and creating life for it, you know, it would go to destruction. And in His good time, He will cease to do this. Secondly, by virtue of its instability, we will continue to have the rumors and the rumblings and the movements on toward the end time. It's sort of like people who had the misfortune to build houses in some of the mountains around Los Angeles, you know, that are very unstable. And every once in a while you get a little and there's a little shifting. And you move closer and closer to going over the cliff. And so every once in a while, we'll have a star, not literally a star, you know, but a large meteor will strike the earth and will remind us we're moving toward end times, or a great earthquake will occur, or a flood will occur, or an avalanche will occur. And we see that we're moving on, and we're moving on to end times. And certainly, anyone who spends time in primitive areas like we do up here in Holden, you see change going on, and you see this eroding away, and this going this way, and so on. And the whole business is moving on toward end times. From a positive side, and I would much prefer to end on a positive side, what this means is that we, on the one hand, can and certainly need to rejoice that our Lord preserves His universe and keeps it. And it keeps it not just because mountains are pretty and flowers are beautiful and things of that sort, but he keeps it because that is where His children are and where His children are going to be found. And He keeps it until He has separated them out from those who will be. And then it no longer will have any purpose, and He'll dispose of it. And secondly, I suppose we may rejoice that He has chosen us and has put His sign of salvation on us and given us the opportunity to work for the end times and to bring the news of Him and His love to our fellow men. Now, happy film watching. Oh, that's kind of hard to say, happy film watching. Interesting film watching tonight when you see the seventh seal. And you will see some symbols, you will see some mysteries, and a kind of frustrating theology that we'll be talking about this afternoon in the general context of Bergman's theology. At the same time, I think even the seventh seal can be understood in a way in which the gospel is there, surprisingly enough. But we'll save that for this afternoon.